Hello and welcome to Outside In Podcast. I'm John Burns and I'm talking to you from a very stormy Inverness right now. As some of you will already know, I purchased a polar sledge towards the end of last year, and that's put a lid on the chances of us getting any snow whatsoever this winter. But it's the weather seems to have decided it's not going to snow, but it's going to make up for that with wind. So it's howling up here. So I'm guessing that most of outdoor folk have not been able to get out very much recently to do the walking that they love. And talking about walking, my guest today is Paul Besley. He's written a book, 1001 Walking Tips. And I guess he's someone who knows a bit about walking. Paul's also a member of a mountain rescue team and has, I think, been, he'll correct me if I'm wrong, is also an outdoor pursuits instructor. So let me introduce Paul Besley. Hello, Paul. How are you?
Hello, John. Lovely to speak to you from Sheffield. We've got clouds scudding across the sky here.
Yes, yeah. Fine place, Sheffield, though, isn't it? I like Sheffield.
Just one correction. I'm not an outdoor instructor.
You're not.
No, okay. Never have been.
Oh, well, I got that wrong there. There's one mistake for a start. No, there will. Just in case you're in any doubt, there will be others. that was just the first one. Now, you've written, you're actually a guidebook writer, though, aren't you? You've written, what guides have you written so far?
Yes, I do. I write guidebooks, and I started on that in the Peak District, writing the three Peak District guidebooks for Cicerone, which was placed in my lap by the previous guidebook writer, who was Mark Richards in the Lake District, who does the Fell Ranger series. And then I went on to do South Pennines for Vertebrae, so day walks in the South Pennines, and now I've just done the walking tips.
Right, okay. And let's talk a little bit about how on earth did you manage to think up 1001 tips?
Well, it started with an email from John saying, do you fancy writing a book?
Right.
And foolishly, I said yes.
That's always a big mistake. I can tell you that from the start. Aye.
And then he dropped the deadline on me. And I got to start writing. So I basically started from the very beginning.
Right, from the very basics. And so,
what's the important things, really?
Mm-hmm.
And that starts the tips off. And the most important thing is to tell someone where you're going and what time you're going to be back.
Yeah, which I very rarely do. Yes, you're quite right.
Yeah, which few people do. And I never used to, apart from the one time, the first time I ever did it, and fell off a mountain.
Is that right? Oh, God.
And got rescued.
Oh, in really?
In part because I'd left a route card with the manager at Holly Howe Youth Hostel.
What, you didn't fall off because you'd left it? Yeah. You were rescued because of that, were you?
I was rescued in part because of that, because I'd already come round and managed to raise the alarm myself, but unbeknownst to him, I had not returned in time, and so he raised the alarm as well. So if I hadn't come round, I would have been rescued because of that man's effort, and he got an award for that.
Oh, right, okay. Well, yeah, obviously, what was his name?
Philip Connor or Conway, who was the manager at Holly Howe, and he's now somewhere else. But he works for the Youth Hostel Association.
Right, well, I think we should give him a bit of a shout-out for getting you rescued there, you know?
Yeah, and Coniston came and rescued me, and along with the old Yellow Bird, the old RAF.
Oh, right, yeah, the old Sea King.
Yes.
Oh, right, very fond memories of the old Sea King from my time in mountain rescue. You're in the middle of nowhere, freezing to death, and this Well, they used to call it the paraffin budgie arrives and just hoiks you into safety. Wonderful, wonderful experience. It smells like, oh, whenever I start a primer stove, it always makes me think of helicopters these days. I don't know why that is.
Yeah.
Tell me, I was interested in the bit of the book that where you wrote about navigation. And as you know, navigation is you know, one of the key skills of all mountaineering and walking. And yet it's one of the things that has changed a lot, because I what I'm doing at the moment is I always prided myself that I would always use a map and compass, and didn't want to go the way of a GPS. But over the last few years, my eyesight has deteriorated to such an extent that particularly when the light levels are low at night and things like that, I suddenly thought to myself, you know, there's no point in you sitting here trying to make out the contours. You might as well get a GPS, which I do use. But one of the things that you said in your book, I think, was that, and I would echo this really, I think that you do lose something in that connection between you and the landscape when you switch from a paper map to a digital device. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, it's certainly true for me. And I think it's true for a lot of people that I've spoken to about it. There's something about the map. There's something about holding a map. There's a photograph in the book of a man on top of Shetland's Law, sat looking at his map and looking at the countryside around him, looking at the landscape. And that wasn't set up. He was just there just as I got to the top and I snatched that photograph.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the thing, it's a bit like writing in a way. When I write, I do a first draft on the keyboard and I clatter away and it's absolute rubbish.
Mm-hmm.
But all the information that I sort of want to get in there is there. The second draft I do by hand because it slows me down and it makes me think. And I think the digital apps, the Ordnance Survey, the What Was View Range and is now Outdoor Active, and all the others, they're brilliant.
Yeah.
They're really, really good. But what they're doing is they're placing technology in between me what I'm seeing and how I interpret it.
Yes.
It's very easy to see where I am with the dot on a screen. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't have to think about it.
Yes.
I think for me that removes something from my experience of being outdoors.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of feel that, you know, when you're using a map and compass alone, you are constantly reading not only the map, but also the landscape. And you notice the little crag up there. You notice, you know, how the river runs through the landscape, because that's the sort of thing that those are the clues that help you get around. But if you're basically just following a little dot, they're wonderful. They really are wonderful. I managed to lose the path coming down a very obscure ridge in the Highlands not long ago. And I wasn't far off, but it was lots of little crags and it was starting to get scrambly and difficult. And I did whip out the GPS and it said, well, basically, you idiot, it's over there. And that was it. I mean, that would have been quite difficult to do with map and compass, but I must admit, I was very impressed with it, you know?
Yeah, and in situations like that, I think they're really good. But what that also does, and I've been in similar situations.
Yeah.
I think what the map and compass helps, it seems to immerse me further in the landscape because I'm having to think and I'm having to interpret and I'm also having to think about how have I ended up here when it looks nothing like what I expected it to look like.
Yes, I know that feeling.
If anybody tells me that they've never been lost, then I don't think they've explored enough.
No. No, that's right. That's right. I mean,
I've walked off the wrong way off of my. I remember being with a group of friends on the top of Ben McDuitt, and we walked up to there. It was a clear day, and we had lunch up there, and then everybody started. We all said, right, that's it. We'll get off back down to the car park, and I walked off the wrong way. I set off the block. Everybody else was going left and I was going straight ahead. And I had to be called over because I just lost that sense of where I was.
Yeah. Well, that's very true, because the easiest place to actually lose your bearings is on a summit, because when you're on the summit, every way is down.
Yes, it is. And the other thing that I was taught as a ranger, and it is very, very true, the hardest part of any walk is getting out of the car park. It's really getting out of the, I have walked out of a car park and then walked back in and out the other way several times.
Well, yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I have similar issues, really. I often go into Highland Bothies, and, you know, you arrive sometimes in the dark, and you're leaving, and there's a gate and a track, and you follow it. And every gate and every track looks pretty much like every other gate and every track.
Yeah.
So you're quite right. You need to be quite careful that you're in the right place when you kind of start out, you know. I mean, one of the things you said in your book, and I think obviously very wise, is that you shouldn't rely solely on any GPS system. You should always have a map and compass. But what struck me about that, though, was that, there must be a lot of people out there who actually have relied for years just on GPS, and to be in a difficult situation where if a GPS goes foot and to have to whip out your map, I should imagine that's pretty difficult, really.
Yeah, and there are lots of, I think, mountain rescue call-outs that are based on that sort of scenario where the phone's gone dead. Kinder Scout is a very common place for this to happen, particularly at the changing of the clocks. It's very common. I've come across people who've been walking to somewhere and they've been using Google Maps.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
The one thing about Google Maps is that everything is green.
Aye.
There are no crags. Everything is green and it's all flat. And life isn't, the world isn't like that. And I've known professional people use Google Maps as well and become stuck. Digital is fantastic. And in terms of when I'm in my other life in MR, you will use digital to make a track. It's quick.
You can quickly
get a location because that's the nature of the game there.
Yes.
When I fell off my mountain, I had to give a location, and I actually did a resection, which is bonkers, but I did a resection and gave my location. The thing with maps, I do understand, I accept what you're saying, that a lot of people have grown up around the digital age now, and they are, that there's a whole generation now that is based on digital.
Absolutely. And nothing wrong with that.
There is absolutely nothing wrong. And there's nothing wrong with the apps. There's nothing wrong with them at all. But I think what a map does, I think a map and compass increase your skill level. And I think that increase in skill level increases enjoyment of the environment that you're in.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is probably an old-fashioned comment, really, but one of the things that obviously, the difficult bit with map and compass, as you know, is that essentially it takes practice, it takes experience. You learn by your mistakes, don't you? And when I was getting into hill walking, I was with a mate who could read a map a bit, and just said, well, we're here and we're going there. And he pointed to a load of squiggles on the map and another lot of squiggles on the map. And it meant absolutely nothing to me. But the enjoyment, in a way, I got some pride and some enjoyment in over a couple of years, learning to actually be able to use a map and be able to interpret and to see the landscape in those squiggles. And it got to the extent that I'm actually really bad at teaching people to read a map, because I just do it, you know, it's like second nature, you know?
Yeah. I mean, every 3 years we have to do, in the team, we have to do a navigation exercise, an assessment, if you like,
right,
which takes place at night in winter, on somewhere like Saddleworth Moor, so very barren.
Oh God, yeah, okay, yeah,
and not good conditions. The last time my visibility was about 5 meters,
right?
And you have to find 5 sticks sticking 12 inch out of the ground, and they're 1 inch square, painted brown.
Oh, great!
Which, if anybody knows the Dark Peak, brown is not the colour you want to be spotting anything.
Not really, no, no.
No, at night especially. And the last time I did my assessment, I fell headfirst into 3 ditches. I got covered in water, ripped my trousers getting over a barbed wire fence to get out of the assessment, but found all 5 and had a fantastic time.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And the sense of achievement of that is phenomenal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I presume, knowing that area, that included a hell of a lot of wading through bogs as well.
Yeah.
Very, very wet area.
Climb your way up peat gruffs. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, God, yes, yes. But peat cloughs are like, I don't know what they are, how to describe them, really, because it's kinder scout you're talking about. It's a bit like the surface of the moon, really, isn't it? It's got these, I suppose they're like small valleys cloughs, aren't they? They're about 6 foot high. They're just high enough so you can't see over them in the next one.
I mean, there's some on the gruffs on Bleaklow. There's some there that are 20 foot high, and I do talk about it in some of the books. About crossing. In fact, on the Dark Peak Walks book, the Cicerone book, I actually do a route through Kinder Scout, through the centre of Kinder Scout, without getting your feet wet, and it's all about pacing and bearings and everything. And people write into me and they'll say, it took me 3 attempts to actually get through.
Aye,
because I got lost every time and stuff. But they really enjoyed it. But the best thing you can do on a peak is to sit and watch someone trying to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's good fun. Because eventually they get to a point where they're in tears, really, and they're covered in peat. They've generally lost some piece of clothing. The expensive Gore-Tex has been completely trashed. And it's at that point, that you should say, would you like any help?
So you wait until they're absolutely desperate, basically, yeah.
Yes. Pleading is the place you want to get to.
Well, yeah, I think you said you'd read my book. So there's a chapter. What happens when we were walking the Pennine Way? I found a guy actually up to his thighs who couldn't get out. We had to haul him out. The joys of peat bogs are quite incredible. What would your advice be? I mean, we all find ourselves sometimes when someone if you get lost, and sometimes it's possible to sort of get so confused and so bamboozled, particularly in thick mist, that you almost don't know which way is up and which way is down, you know? What if you get into a situation like that, what would your advice be?
If it's very difficult to be anywhere in this country, certainly in England, where you can't see or hear a road, it's very difficult. But there are places like that.
Yeah.
If you become lost, the safest thing, and you definitely, and you're really lost, sit down and have a think first. Think about the last place where you could get back to where you knew you were.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you can do that safely, then do that. Get back to the place last known. If you can't do that, stay where you are. Find some shelter and stay, even if it's behind a wall or in a gruff, whatever, but stay where you are. If you're truly lost, get to some ground where you've got a phone signal and do phone Mountain Rescue. Phone 999, ask for police, Mountain Rescue, and then speak to them. Quite often, Mountain Rescue have their own location system, and they can send you a text message, which, when you reply to it, gives Mountain Rescue the exact grid reference that you're at.
Oh, right. I didn't know that. That's pretty handy, isn't it?
So stay where you are and do not move.
Yeah.
The worst kind of search is when the person is moving around.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I suppose, you know, as you say, in England and Wales, you know, you certainly, if you sort of follow a rough bearing, like you sort of keep moving north or something, you should eventually hit a road or something like that, really. I would have thought.
Yes, yeah.
Most of the time.
But there are places I'm going to talk about this at the book launch. During the last 2 years, lots of people have been going up to the aircraft wrecks up on Bleaklow.
Oh, yeah.
Because the social media has been awash with images of them. And it's an interesting thing to do. But the people that have been going up there have not been used to that environment. Mm-hmm. And that's the critical point. They're not used to the environment. They're not doing anything wrong. They're not stupid or anything. Mm-hmm. They're just not used to that environment. And they park the car up. And how hard can it be? They can still see the road. How hard can it be?
Yeah.
But they walk up the Pennine Way, and the Pennine Way takes a sharp left back to the Snake Summit. And if you're not paying attention, you carry straight on and you end up in Alport Dale, which is a dale that is extremely difficult to get out of. It's very, very, it was the scene of the four-inch tragedy in 1964 when some young Rover Scouts died in there.
Right.
Because they got lost in it. And that's what happened. People just don't pay attention.
Mm.
Because the road, the image of the road, the sight of the road, gives them a sense of I've got out of my house, I've got in my car, it's nice and warm, I've driven up, I've got out my car, I've parked my car, there's a nice path there with stone slabs. And then I head off, I go and see this wreck, I come back, I walk on my path, and suddenly I'm not on the path, I'm in this very deep gorge and I don't know where I am.
Yeah. I mean, I think
that's what happens.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I was involved in mountain rescue myself, but I've never rescued an idiot. I've rescued people who were inexperienced, and you can't buy experience. You have to earn it and gain it. You can't go into a mountaineering shop and buy two packets of experience. It doesn't work like that. And you know. We both, you and I am sure, many years ago, of course, and perhaps more recently with myself, I've made many blunders, you know, and we've got out of them. But I think everyone's in the same the same boat, really.
When the clocks go by, there's always rescues on Kinder, and people are up there. And it's maybe their first time up on Kinder. Maybe it's the first time out walking at that time of year. Mm. How would someone know that they need to have a torch if they've never been in that environment?
Yes, that's right. You don't. It is not.
And that's partly what the book does. My very first walk was when I was 14 years old, and I went with a mate, and we were going to walk from Crowden Youth Hostel over to Edale across Bleaklow and Kinder, having never walked before ever.
All right, okay.
And I got a pair of boots from Wakefield's Army Stores that I'd hammered segs into. Remember segs?
Oh my God!
Segs sounded as though you were crunching, and it sounded professional.
That's going back a bit. That is.
Yeah. I got a pair of I got a gas mask sack with a bottle of pop in it and some sandwiches and a woolly jumper and a plastic anorak. Not a cagoule, a plastic anorak. And we set off the bus drops off at Crowden, and we set off walking along the Woodhead. So this is in 1972.
Oh, wow.
And we got as far as Charlesworth, having never stepped off a road, and called in a news agent to ask the way to Kinder Scout, who then said to us, you're best off going back to Sheffield. So we set off back on the road to Sheffield. We didn't have a map. We had a guidebook that had one of those funny line drawings in it.
Oh, Jesus.
So we set off walking back to Sheffield. A storm hit. We called at a house. They slammed the door on us because we were just stood there shouting, can you please let us in? And they shut the door. So then we got to the youth hostel, which used to have a phone box outside, and we didn't go in the youth office because we weren't members. So we hid in the phone box. He phoned his dad. His dad came and got us, gave us such a rollicking. But here's the thing. The next week, we bought a map and we set off from Fox House and walked the gritstone edges down to Baslow and had a great day.
Right. Yeah.
I always think about that. I always think that it was amazing that our parents let us out again for a start.
Yeah, well.
But also that we didn't know we needed to have a map.
That's right. Yeah.
No one had told us. And then what started? We started to go on a Sunday morning from Sheffield bus station, and there'd be hundreds of walkers getting on the buses, and they'd all be asking you where you were going, and they'd suggest you do this and you do that, and you built up your skill level.
That's right.
And there were times where you realised you didn't have the skills to do something. So you went to the library and got a book, or you paired up with some older person who had the skills
learnt
off them.
Yeah. I think in many ways the internet has changed that, hasn't it? And not necessarily for the better. I think because, as you say, when I learned to climb and stuff like that, the only way to do it was to go to a club and get taught by other people who were probably only slightly more competent than you were. But we're so used to having information at our fingertips these days that you don't actually know what you don't know, if that makes sense. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah. The beginning of the book starts with the quote, which I think is Mark Twain, and I think it's attributed to Mark Twain. And it says, "It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so."
Very true.
And that's really, really true.
Yeah.
We often look for people, we often come across people who don't know that they're lost.
Yes. I think the most common phrase I think that people say just before they get lost is, "It must be this way."
Yes.
because it's when you, the times that I've got lost, it's always when I thought, "Oh, it's got to be this way, it can't be any other way." And about half an hour later, you're thinking, "Where the bloody hell am I?" You know.
the biggest teaching experience I ever had was we walked out of the Langdales up onto the top, up onto there.
Yeah.
And it hammered it down. There was me and my wife and the dogs, and we were camping down at the bottom of the campsite in Langdale.
As
we started to go up past Stickle Tarn and the lights, it started to hammer it down. And we spent the day, we went over to Harrison Pike, is it?
Yeah.
And then came back and started to drop down to the bridleway that runs you back to Dungeon Hill.
Right, I know it, yeah.
Which we had to cross several streams that are now raging.
Right.
So anyway, we get onto the bridleway, the main track. And I say to Alison, "Right, okay, it's down that way." And Alison said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Yeah, it's definitely down that way." She said, "It's not down the other way." "No," I said, "we definitely go right down there." Okay. So Alison sets off in some dudgeon, to be honest. And it's quite a way ahead of me. And when she gets to the bottom, it's about a 2,000-foot drop. You're descending 2,000 feet.
Yeah.
Over about a mile and a half, maybe 2 miles. And then when she gets to the bottom, I'm still coming down, and I can see that she stood on a bridge. And I'm thinking, I don't remember there being a bridge on the map.
Oh God. Okay.
I don't remember that. And we get as I get closer to her, and she stood there knowingly, it dawns on me that we've turned right and we should have turned left. In fact, she was right. We should have gone the other way. So my way out of this is to say to her, "Well, we'll just keep walking. By this time, we're off the end of the map. There's nothing else. And I've no idea what's further down this valley."
Right.
And she says, "Don't be an idiot." We've got to walk all the way back up there now to where we were, and then down the other side, which is what we did in the in the storm, in the rain.
Oh God! Okay, okay.
Then got back to the campsite, which was well and truly flooded out.
I know it.
The drying room was absolutely packed with wet gear, and it was an extremely quiet night in the tent.
Yes, I was just wondering how many years it took before she started talking to you again.
and I really learned the lesson: always check your map.
Well, we're almost out of time. It seems to have flown by this this little conversation, Paul. What is it that draws you? What's the main thing that attracts you to walking itself?
Walking is and always has been, even in the worst days of weather and the epics, has been about enjoying being outside, enjoying the environment, and it is a physical and mental and at times almost a spiritual experience.
And I always feel that one of the things that walking does is it puts you in not just in touch with, but in contact with the landscape. And you know, what are we as people? I think we evolve to move through landscape. That's what we're for, really. And I think that's why I think all of us get so much out of it. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, there's a point on every walk that I do where something settles physically inside of me. Mm-hmm. And there's no place I would sooner be. And I know that this is where I'm meant to be. And that happens on every walk. And I think that's a really powerful thing.
Absolutely. And I think it's why I think, well, you and I have probably been walking for, I guess, more than 40 years each or something like that now. And it's something that pulls you back again and again. Listen, Paul, thanks very much for talking to me. It's been absolutely fascinating. And I think we've probably got a few more conversations to have, really. And so I'd like to ask you, invite you back onto Outside In, maybe to explore some of the other ideas that you've got, you know. Just to say again, everybody, if you've enjoyed this little podcast, don't forget that Paul's book, 1001 Walking Tips, is available direct from Vertebrate. And I'll put links to that on the podcast page. But it's been a real pleasure having you, Paul. Thanks very much for coming. And I hope to speak to you again.
Thanks, John. Thanks for asking me. And I would look forward to another talk.
Thanks very much, Paul. Thanks then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed Paul and me batting the breeze there on a fairly rambling little conversation there. I'm sure it was. But I'll be putting links on the page to Paul's books if you'd like to see more of them and find out more about what Paul's got to say and his fascinating insights into the world of walking. I think that Paul will be speaking at the Sheffield Adventure Film Festival on the 20th of March. I don't know if this is actually out on the film festival's website yet, but if you keep an eye open for that, you'll be able to go along and meet Paul and hear some of his insights about the outdoor world. So again, that's the 20th of March at Sheffield Adventure Film Festival. I do hope you've enjoyed my little podcast. I've been John Burns, and if the wind ever stops, I'll be getting out walking too. You take care. I hope you enjoy your outdoors. Bye-bye.